相隔我就拜了，相隔和你玩了夜里家家和你下个夜入门了，相隔
brothers and sisters. We are here at the Black Reality Think Tank. This is our maiden voyage for our program. We're here tonight. This is here every Tuesday night from 8 to 10 p.m. I am your host, William Rogers. We have summoned our ancestors and the African gods to join us here in what we hope will be an inspiring conversation. The Black Reality Think Tank is designed to provide historical analysis and discussions on the African-American experience. And so we feel empowered because we know that our ancestors will join us. Every week here on Tuesday night, we will discuss and have an opportunity to share our thoughts with you, our listening audience, as well as our guests. Well, we appreciate your patronage and your gift that you have given us in your spirit and love to make this program happen. Each week we want to feature an ancestor. What we would like to do is focus on somebody. We want to always recognize our ancestors. The great Fannie Lou Hamer said in a message once that we must always praise the bridges that brought us over. We must always praise the bridges that brought us over. So tonight at our maiden voyage, we want to recognize a very dynamic young man who is, may not be familiar to a lot of us, but tonight you'll get a chance to see him and introduce him. His name is Hubert Harrison. Hubert Harrison. Hubert Harrison was born in St. Croix of the Virgin Islands in 1883. At the age of 17, he traveled to New York, where he worked as a bellhop and an elevator operator. He also attended night school and studied sociology and science and psychology and literature and drama. Harrison's studies radicalized him, and he became a member of the Industrial Workers of the World. He later joined the Socialist Party, where he met other African-American radicals, such as A. Philip Randolph, Chandler Owen, and Claude McKay. He impressed them with his intellect and was given the nickname the Black Socrates. Mack Eastman, who was the editor at the time of a magazine called The Masses, employed him on his journal. Harrison also edited The Voice and contributed to The Messenger, The Call, The New Republic, The New York Times, and The New York World. He also published two very important books that are available. One book is called The Negro and the Nation. It was published in 1917. And second, When Africa Awakes, published in 1920. Harrison was a strong opponent of United States involvement in the First World War. This caused him to break with the great W.E.B. Du Bois, who had argued in the crisis that let us, while this war lasts, forget our special grievances and close our ranks. Harrison lectured around the country on socialism and African-American civil rights from street corners, and in September of 1922, the New York Times reported that he was drawing crowds of over 10,000 people, and the New York police had to stop the traffic. It is claimed that Harrison had a great influence on the great Marcus Messiah Garvey. Harrison, who is now claiming that race was more important than class, and after leaving the Socialist Party, he joined the Universal Negro Improvement Association. Harrison also edited the organization's journal, The Negro World, for 4 years. He also worked as a staff lecturer for the New York City Board of Education. Hubert Harrison died in 1927. A wonderful ancestor. So we want to introduce him tonight on our maiden voyage, because tonight we're going to talk about Black Power. We want to talk about the Black Power movement historically, talk about its significance, what is its relevance today, kind of look at some of the ideology of it and see if that's some things that we can use today in terms of the continued struggle of African-American liberation. I have a special guest that's going to join me. He's a very good and powerful friend, a young man who has been a frequent member of the Black Reality Think Tank program. His name is Mr. James Pugh. He is a community philosopher, and he is going to share some of his political philosophy and ideas as it relates to the Black Power movement. So, again, I'm really pleased to be here. There's so many people to thank for this opportunity. Definitely would start off by thanking Brother Elliot, who is the host of Time for an Awakening a program. This is a part of the Time for Awakening network, which is a part of Black Talk Radio Network. And we are also a part of Motherland Media, which is hosted by Brother Oshiemi Adelabu every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And I'm going to give you, our audience, a list of the programs that do air on this network, so you can, obviously, if you don't already know that, join some of those talks as well in discussions. So this is really a great opportunity for the Black Reality Think Tank here. We have a wonderful platform that we have been using on Blog Talk Radio that comes on Saturdays from 4 to 6. We will continue to do that. That's our weekend edition of Black Reality Think Tank, and this is our weekly edition. So we'll be here every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m., and we are looking forward to some really dynamic discussions coming up in the weeks to follow. Also, I want to mention that we have a wonderful support staff of folk, people like Xandra Collins and Mr. Marcus Boyd, who are graduate students at Howard University. They help with some of the research efforts that are needed, because basically the Black Reality Think Tank is a historical format. We do look at history. But one of the things that's most important for us is that we try to present resources so that many of you, our listening audience, can follow through yourselves and participate in study groups and do these community kinds of things that are necessary to learn who we are, what we have done, where we are going, and what is it that we must always do. And so Definitely. We think that we want to be able to contribute to some of that with you in this community and talk about some of the many, many resources that are available to study and look at the journey of our people. One of the other things is that we want to make sure we always, as I said, pay attention to our contemporary things. You know, even though this is a historical format, we do from time to time like to discuss the contemporary issues that we are facing and sort of tie them to history and let us have an opportunity to see how they do blend together. Because as Dr. John Henry Clark said, all of history is a covered event. All of history is a covered event. And we at the Black Reality Think Tank do embrace that idea, and a lot of our program is formatted after that. So I'm hopefully that Mr. Pugh is with me now online. He is coming in from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and we definitely are looking forward to having him discuss some of the ideas that you're on. Mr. Pugh, are you there yet?
Yes, Dr. Rogers, I'm available.
Right. Thank you so much. Good afternoon to you, my brother.
Yes, good evening.
Good, great. Tonight we're going to talk a little bit about the Black Power Movement from the 1960s and look at its relevancy and kind of understand a little bit about where it would fit in 2018. There's been many discussions and formats I've seen where that was brought up. Was it successful as a movement in the 60s? Did it achieve what it needed to achieve? As we look at organizations like the Black Panthers and some of the things that are going on. And I think the reason that's important is because some of the same issues and behavior that were being addressed by the Black Power Movement in the 1960s has not diminished in 2018. And so we want to see what is it that we need to do to elevate our efforts if we're going to use this format to do that. Because in some cases, you know, this idea was in direct conflict sometimes with other civil rights efforts, you know, who wanted to approach this from a different perspective. And so then I would question that too. Was it successful? And if so, what was its impact and what was it able to do? The Black Power slogan, the concept Black Power, basically is associated with an ideology aimed at ideas around self-determination and Black nationalism, and it is designed for people of African descent. It's been used by African Americans quite often in the United States. It was very prominent, as you know, in the 1960s and 1970s, emphasizing things like racial pride and the creation of Black political and cultural institutions to nurture and promote Black collective interests and advance Black values. Black Power has the tendency to express a range of political concepts and ideas, from things like defense against racial oppression to the establishment of even institutions and self-sufficient economy. It has all embraced it. One of the organizations that currently presents here on Time for Awakening, ULU, Us Lifting Us, basically embraces that Black Power idea and concept. And so it has done that from the 60s onward. The earliest known usage of the term basically is from in 1954. It came out of a book by Richard Wright called Black Power. Adam Clayton Power, Jr., the congressman from New York, pastor of the Abyssinian Baptist Church in New York City, used the term back in the late 60s, where he was addressing a group of students at Howard University. And in that speech, he said, to demand these God-given rights is to seek Black Power. And he used it then. But the most popular use of it, as we know, Black Power, is based on the words of Kwame Ture, formerly Stokely Carmichael, and Willie Ricks, who was called Mukasa Dada. And both these organizers and the spokesmen who were part of the organization of SNCC on June 16, 1966, in a speech in Greenwood, Mississippi, after James Meredith had been shot, made that statement, Black Power. Soka Carmichael said, this is the 27th time I have been arrested, and I ain't going to jail no more. The only way we're going to stop them white men from whipping us is to take over. What we're going to start saving now is black power. And Stokely saw the concept of black power as a means of uniting and bringing together our people and individuals and movements. It was a placement of the word that was being used during the civil rights years called Freedom Now, which was the slogan also of Carmichael's contemporary Martin Luther King. He was saying Freedom Now. Stokely said, never mind Freedom Now, black power. And so with this use of the term, Carmichael felt the movement was not just for racial desegregation. That wasn't the goal and objective of black power, but rather one of self-sufficiency, one to stop American racism that was tipping to weaken blacks and to weaken the black family and movement. So he said black power means that black people coming together to form a political force at either electing representatives for forcing their representatives to speak their own needs. And so over time, over the 60s, since that was done, we saw a range of activities taking place. We saw people raising the idea of black nationalism. We saw things like self-determination, even moving right into the Kwanzaa principles. We saw black separatism ideas, the civil rights movement. We saw that. We saw black art taking on a format. One of the most dynamic concepts of the black power idea in a artistic thing was done by the great writer, poet, playwright, Imamu Amira Baraka, who was one of my favorite artists. I recall him doing a play called The Dutchman. And The Dutchman was a very powerful piece that spoke to what was happening to black people in America. Is that America had done like a woman and had seduced black people into believing that life here was good, and all of the tinklings and wealth and beauty of America was what we needed to have. And obviously, in his play, he spoke to the fact that it was going to kill you, that it killed us. But that was a dynamic piece. But that was a wonderful example of use of the artistic spirit to deal with black power. And then I'm going to just mention a few other things, and then I'm going to go over to Mr. Pugh and ask him a couple of questions. One of the other things that we saw is we actually saw some organizations stand up in very strong self-defense. We saw, obviously, the Black Panther Party and this organization who stood tall and strong against self-defense. We saw organizations like the Beacons of Defense, out of the South, who stood up and said, we're not going to let these folks keep coming in here doing that to us and killing our children and disrespecting our women. And so they stood up even against what was known as some very terrible odds, which brought the ire of people like the infamous J. Edgar Hoover, who took a personal vendetta against the Klan and some of the COINTELPRO material that organized around Jimmy Carter, even the Johnson administration, and a whole cadre of other executive leaders of this country, and attempting to shut down any effort of the African experience to organize any self-defense mechanism. And so the black power of that idea even took on stronger images during the whole struggle of the South African movement, Nelson Mandela, the African National Congress, the ANC, it really even gained strength. And then some of the other West African countries that were gaining their independence, they were able to step in and be a part of that. We should not forget also the great Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam and the work that they did in terms of black power, and what they're still doing in terms of black power, the Nation of Islam. Musicians like John Coltrane wrote very dynamic pieces of music in that vein of black power and defense. One of the dynamic pieces that he did was a song. He wrote a jazz suite called Alabama, Birmingham, Bombing. And that's a powerful, dynamic piece of music that embraces the whole Black nationalist, Black power movement. And there were other jazz musicians as well. And one of the things that we like to do here on the Black Rhythm Hour Think Tank is we may go back and look at that music and begin to try to see and discuss that. And so with that, I guess what I like to always do is always say, well, what has this got to do with now? And kind of, you know, answer that question and leap off from that. Well, a lot of what, as I said earlier, what they were fighting and the challenges that we had in the 60s, I was a byproduct of the 60s. I was living in the Carolinas in the South. I recall very clearly some of the behavior and the attitude that was going on throughout the South. I was a student at A&T College in Greensboro, North Carolina at the time. I was there when Jesse Jackson was the president of the student council. I was a freshman that year. And that whole Greensboro sit-in, I recall marching, going down to Greensboro. So I kind of know that the attitude and the behavior that we were experiencing then is a lot of the same attitude and behavior that we're experiencing right now. And so the key then is to ask the question, what did those movements do and how can we take them and launch into a more aggressive attitude now? We still have some of the same type players. The man that now heads the Justice Department is probably no different than J. Edgar Hoover. The man that sits in the seat in the White House is no different than a Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and some of those other individuals like that. So it's an opportunity for us to sort of tie all of this together. Let's ask ourselves, you know, are we doing all that we can do to stop this? Some of our children are being still shot in the streets and killed. We are still having people doing crazy things like walk into a church and attempt to assassinate everybody in there. And the only thing that could be said about it was, let's forgive them. And that just, to me, just drives me crazy just to even think about that. And some of the other things where young Black men are being stopped, police officers are shooting them and killing them right there in their car with their children witnessing it. So what has changed, okay? Do we need to reinvigorate the Deacons of Defense? Do we need to reinvigorate the Black Panther Party? Is it time? Is the Black Lives Matter enough of a movement? Where's the NAACP? What about the moral majority right there? Well, actually, it's the one run by my brother out of North Carolina. It's part of the NAACP. Is that enough? Or what do we need to do? And so that's our discussion for today. So, Mr. Pugh, I want to start off and ask you, just go right into it from the heart of the matter. And the matter is, are we doing enough to combat some of the challenges that are going on in our community? What do you think?
Yes, I think we're moving, the way that we need to move.
Give us a description. Can you give me a kind of description of what is it that you think we are doing? What is it that we're doing?
The first thing I think to understand Black Power, you know, there needs to be an understanding of that concept. But one of the things I'll just talk. First of all, I'm going to put Black Power in context. And I'd like to update Kwame Ture. He said something recently that might be useful here. But one of the things I'll just put in context is that, you know, one of the first of all, anything I say as a philosopher is always going to have four elements to it. It's always going to have a physical element. That's the starting point. Everything begins with some kind of building blocks. Next, there's a logical element. That is to say, you take these physical elements and you have to arrange them in some kind of way, and that's a logical element.
Mm-hmm.
Thirdly, is that these logical elements, they benefit some specific group and harm some other group. That's the social dimension. And then the fourth dimension of everything I say is always going to, there's always going to be an evaluation. In other words, how well did it benefit this group, or how poorly did it benefit this group? And so to give you one example of that, when we look at black activities for the last 50 years, for example, or certainly even for the last 20 years, there are four kinds of activities that we can think about. One of the activities is the let me back up and give one other model just before I do that. When you look at a community has four things. It has children in it, it has youth in it, it has adults in it, and it has elders in it. And so whenever you start talking about black power, you're talking about power for a people, which means power for a community. And so when you look at the activities that we've done over the last 20 years, for example, one of the things that you see is that you can see the kind of activities that we've done relative to these elements of our community. So, for example, the Black Lives Movement is fundamentally a movement at the physical level, at the level of the child, because it's fundamentally asking the question, the Black Lives Matter movement. It's basically asking the question, can we exist, you know, in the society, period? So it's the question of whether or not we can even exist in the country. And mm-hmm. so there's effort there.
Okay.
The second movement is directed to the youth, and that is that assuming that I can exist, now the next thing, in order for me to be viable in the society, I need to be educated. And the archetypal educational strategy that we've had in the last 20 years that you can think about was the No Child Left Behind idea, this concept that there are people being left behind in this society and that we ought not to be left behind. Now, the third level of activity that we've had over the last 20 to 50 years is that it refers to the adult level, is that assuming that you survive, assuming that you get an education, well, the next thing you need to do is you need to be viable as an adult. You need to be, you know, have some kind of way to sustain yourself. And that's where affirmative action came in, this notion that we ought to be able to participate fully in this society. And then the final dimension that we've had is that, in fact, one of the problems that, you know, that we talk about is the notion of being, of driving while black. And what that really addresses is the final dimension of our struggle, and that's at the elder level, and that's black power. Because what that's talking about is that I live long enough to get an education. With that education, I was able to get a job or get some, you know, some kind of economic toehold. And with that economic toehold, I developed a lifestyle. And the problem was that the lifestyle I developed made some people jealous. And so they arrested me for driving while black, et cetera, right? And so what black power is the ability now to express your ways of being in the world. And by the way, let me just mention one other thing, because that's going to be critical, I think, if we really want to understand this. What I'm saying when you talk about a community, what a community needs to be free is it needs the same things that a rabbit needs to be free. It needs freedom from fear, that is, the ability to defend itself and the ability to offend its enemies. That's the first dimension, and that has to do with the Black Lives Matter. That's at the level of the child. That's the existential definition of freedom. But the second definition of freedom that you have to have, it's at the level of the youth, and that's the freedom to speak. Because in order for you to continue to exist in the planet, you've got to be able to communicate internally to your children, and you got to be able to communicate externally to others and to your enemies. And so if you don't have the freedom to speak, then you don't have that ability to communicate.
Okay.
The third kind of freedom that human beings need to have and that rabbits need to have is that even if you have a way to defend yourself or hide from your enemies, even if you have a way to propagate children, to communicate with others, unless you have a wherewithal, unless you have some ability to produce the things you need to consume and the ability to consume the things that you produce, then you're not going to be viable. And so that's the third freedom that you have to have, and that's at the level of the adults. It's the freedom to produce what you need and the freedom to consume the things you produce. One of the critiques in our society is this notion of, being a welfare recipient, that when you consume without producing, there's a stigma associated with it, and it leads to a kind of debilitating set of actions. Now, the third kind of freedom that you have to have is that it turns out that the world is a dynamic place, and whatever strategy you use to defend yourself against your enemies, whatever strategies you use to communicate, and whatever strategies you use to produce, these strategies may become less viable as a function of time. Therefore, you have to have the ability to adjust these strategies. And that's what the elder dimension of freedom is all about. That's the freedom to worship. And by the way, these are the four freedoms that Franklin Roosevelt talked about. So, and by the way, if it's new, it's not true. And if it's true, it's not new. So this ain't, you know, ain't nothing new anybody's going to tell you that's of any truth. And so
and you're basically saying that this is in operation right now in our community.
It's always in operation. And one of the issues that you have is that one of the ways to see it is you have to recognize that truth crushed to earth will rise. And so it is true that if you suppress me, that some of my behavior will attenuate. But the minute that you take the pressure off, all of a sudden my behavior is going to restore its natural dimension.
Okay.
I'll just pause there and let you get the benefit of a question or critique or something.
Okay. I want to let our listening audience know you're listening to the Black Reality Think Tank. We are here every Tuesday. This is from 8 to 10 p.m. This is our maiden voyage of the program. We are really pleased. I'm your host, William Rogers. We still have a few things that we need to do. So right now, in terms of our equipment and getting it up to par so that we can independently operate all of the features that, you know, we have available to us. So right now I am operating with Brother Elliot, who is helping us to do some things until we are able to complete the setup. With Brother Kwaku out of Atlanta is also working with me. He has been a consultant in trying to help pull us together. And so we are still on it. So if you want, we'd like to encourage you to please call area code 215-490-9832. 9832. We would like for your participation in this discussion. Again, I repeat, that number is 215-490-9832. And we welcome you to call us. And so Brother Elliot will pick those calls up for us. And so I do not have the privilege of knowing what's
going on.
And, there,
you,
so
and you do have a call. So do you want me to, you want to take
yes,
it?
Yes, could you please,
all
yes,
right.
please open up for me. Thank you. Good afternoon, caller. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank.
Yes, can you hear me, sir?
Caller?
Can you hear me, sir?
Yes, I can. Yes, thank you.
Oh, good, good. Dr. Rogers.
Yes, sir. How you doing?
Good. We talked last time, and you were on the Time for the Awakening with Brother Elliot. I'm here in Philadelphia with Brother Elliot. And
right,
I think the last conversation that you and I talked about, we were talking about Du Bois.
That's
and,
right. You did.
Right,
oh, yeah.
Exactly.
I do remember. I remember that. Yes, indeed.
Exactly.
Okay.
And, sir, I pulled up my library that book by
okay.
the co-authoring with Du Bois and Booker T. Washington. It's called The Negro in the South.
That's exactly what it was, because I looked it up, too, after we closed, because I wanted to remember the name of it.
Exactly. And I was saying that with the model of the Booker T. Washington's machine, to underneath it all, you can have the classical education with the vocational education.
Right.
And just recently, I did some reading on the Tuskegee Expedition, where some folks came to Booker T. Washington's Tuskegee machine, and they wanted to help him by sending some folks from his machine to certain parts of Africa. And
mm-hmm.
I think that he was able to put together from his agriculture and his knowledge of machinery a way to produce cotton for them. And
right,
I think,
exactly.
And I, I think the name of it was called the Tuskegee Expedition. Is that true?
Right. Yeah. Well, that expedition where he went and made that speech in Atlanta was a part of him looking at the possibilities of, you know, getting into cotton production, because you know, obviously our people were the ones that were really the main crux of that industry, and so he wanted to sort of use that as a platform to sort of do some civil rights work, you know, in the Booker T. way, and that's why that was the purpose of him going there. He wasn't necessarily wanted. If you ever really read look into the whole thing around that cotton expedition speech. There's a lot going on there that he was doing. That's not just what you saw. It was a lot there that he had going on for him. And so you're right by bringing that up. He did. There was some effort. And see, that was the thing that we were trying to say, and it really kind of ties into this discussion we have now about community work. What is it that we've got to do and how we got to do it? That was Booker T. was really working on an economic arm. He was I'll be honest with you. I know what the stigmatization has been about him, but that was Black Power that he was doing at Tuskegee,
exactly.
And he was doing it in a way that was he obviously had to be covert, and he was doing it in a way that was going to be effective, and he had people in place to do that. The Negro Business League, I don't think that has been really studied carefully. And Mr. Pugh might know a little bit of something about that Negro Business League, but the Negro Business League was really an example of where he was going to go throughout the country and grab some of the outstanding Black businesses that were around in America and pull them together in a cooperative kind of way to do things like jobs, starting banks, saving and loans, and things that would provide an ongoing source of revenue into the Black community. And so you got to really, careful research needs to be done to do that. Do you have any information on that, Mr. Pugh, in terms of the that whole?
No, other than that, we know that can't be viable. In other words, we know that we had World War One, and World War One was precisely that kind of nationalist model that he's advancing there, and that the whole reason for Tulsa, the whole reason for Eatonville and Durham and so on, was the jealousy. So there's some political work that has to be done, and the problem that you have when you don't do that political work, in other words, when you think that you can just do some economic work, is that you end up with a situation where other groups say that, well, they can take, you know, the stuff that you have. And so to protect the stuff you have, you've got to do it politically. And you can't do it politically, in the back rooms. It's got to be established policy in the society. And I think you see it with World War One. That's what it was all about. In fact, you see it with this idiot Trump today talking about this, tariffs and stuff. This kind of, you know, let us get ours, and you know, and get the advantage,
right,
over other people. So
right, exactly. You know, and to my brother, I think you're right about looking at that Booker T. Washington Du Bois piece. I mean, there's some powerful blueprint in there that can be looked at today very carefully. The Philadelphia Negro that Du Bois did was a great model of community examination and breaking how to really look critically at a community, obviously the Philadelphia community that he was examining in his work, and how he did that. Those are powerful tools. So you were right to go back and get that book and look at it.
Hey, I have another question for you, sir. Can you tell me the vision of Marcus Garvey's idea of Africa, and can you give me the difference between Du Bois's idea of going back to Africa or being a Pan-Africanist? What was the difference between Garvey's vision and plan, and what was the difference between Du Bois's vision and plan?
Okay, well, first of all, I think the vision of going back to Africa, the whole colonization idea and concept, obviously, you know, did not start with Garvey. one of the earliest plans and envision of going back to Africa started with Prince Hall.
Oh, really?
Yes, indeed. Prince Hall attempted to organize a group of men in Boston and to pull together a group to go back to Africa. They went to the Boston legislature and appealed to attempted to make an appeal, like Mr. Pugh said. They tried to do the political thing and work on some political areas to get a colonization movement approved there in the city of Boston in the 1700s.
Wow.
And it was shut down. You know, they weren't going to approve that. But he did attempt. But he set into motion where Paul Cuffy came right after him in the early 1800s. And Paul Cuffy's movement, and Paul Cuffy did go back to Africa. He did send a ship and go back into Liberia and attempt it, but it was short-lived, too, because at that point, the War of 1812 broke out, and at that point, America had created an embargo where no ships could go in and out of the country, out of the Atlantic waters, and so the War of 1812 shut down the Paul Cuffy movement. But very clearly, those were ideas. Now, the reason, again, is obviously the cruelty that they knew Africans were enduring here in this country. The literature and the discussion of those that were involved, they were speaking to those ideas that go back to where there's a better ground. But there was some trouble with that, too. There was problems with that because, first of all, Liberia, as you know, was purchased by America under James Monroe, under the Monroe plan. And so, again, America had something to do with that. And then, plus, once they got in there and they saw all the resources, all the rubber trees and all of those products that Liberia had, then going to shut down talking about any independent black nation, you know. And then all of that was going on at the same time the French Revolution, the Haitian Revolution, and all of that was going on, and so there were people saying, you can't let these black folks get in here and start no independent nothing, you know.
Right.
And so that was it. But the idea was to go back and be able to reorganize as another nation. That was a nation-building project.
Okay, so what was the boys' vision then? What was the boys was going to do with the talented tip? What was his vision of Pan-Africanism?
Well, his vision was integration. His vision was staying in America. And it was the whole idea of building a better America and building it in a way where we could all live together in a sense. That was the early part of the Du Bois movement. That was the early part of his vision was to, you know, because as you know, even in founding the NAACP and you know, all of those were integrationist ideas. Those ideas were we can work together with whites, and he involved himself with that. Because again, one of the elements about Du Bois that people haven't really looked at and covered very well, I think it is in his in the biography that was done by him. He also did an autobiography, but I don't think he talked about it in detail as his biographer did. Was the fact that Barrington, Massachusetts, his hometown where he came from, was a project started by Quakers.
Right.
And the whole idea was to create an integrated community, but an integrated community of trained and polished people, both black and white. So that was a project. And that's how he got to go to Harvard, because the idea was, that we've got an example of this community. And so here we're getting ready to send you an example of it, you know, and that was in the effort of Du Bois and how he did. And so it gets a little deeper than that, but that's a part of it. There were a lot of those projects like that throughout America. There's evidential strength that Durham, North Carolina was one of those communities that was created like that. The Duke family and this paternalism and this careful hand-picking and crossbreeding would work. So that was Du Bois' thing. Du Bois wanted to do stuff here in America. I think his vision for Africa came later when he ended up going back in with Nkrumah and living in Ghana. That was a later He came to realize after a while that, hey, that's not going to work. You know, this is not going to work. And I agree with Mr. Pugh. The politic wasn't set up to do that. And I don't know if that politic can ever be set up to do that, because this government is not open for that kind of development.
So how are we calling Du Bois a Pan-Africanist then?
How to do what?
Why are we calling him a Pan-Africanist then? If he comes at the later part of his life.
Yeah, that was his latter. That was the latter part, and that came around the time that those African nations started getting their independence, and we started seeing Senegal, Burkina Faso, Nigeria, Ghana. These were nations now who had all these ton of resources, but they had these African leaders. So the idea now is, okay, we got some control of Africa. Let's all come. Let's focus back on Africa again. And start pushing towards that. See, that came after the independence. Called during colonialism, the colonial period, that wasn't going to happen. You know, because all that was still under the French, the British, the Germans, the Dutch. You know, they were still in charge of those tribes.
Okay, one more thing I wanted to ask you, sir. This is such a great program you got with you and Elliot and everybody that I'm talking to. How does Marcus Garvey end up in England at the end?
At the end.
Wow.
Well, you know, Garvey's early years, he was back and forward with that. I think you have to look at sometimes how you're dealing with how money and collaborators come together. England is strange. England is it's a weird. You got elements in England. That sort of sometimes open their doors to a person like a Garvey, to a person like a Malcolm, because you got these Oxfords and these the Scotland, University. You got another kind of thing going on there, and I think that requires some careful movement. But I think there were certain parts of England that was open to that, and even France as well, because you got to remember a lot of our radical writers ended up trying to go to Europe. They went to France. They had a community over in France, and they were still biased in against the black race, but they were a little bit more peaceful than here in America, because in America, the violence, was at the helm. I think that's my interpretation, is that England was still a little bit more of where you could go in and develop and get hold of some resources and come back and do something. So maybe Garvey saw an opportunity there. Plus, Jamaica was under the influence of the British from its colonial years. It was a British colony. Yeah, so maybe there were some connections out of that. I don't know the specifics, but I think I can look at the historical factors that are involved there, just kind of draw some kind of conclusion England was so important for him at that time.
Okay, I'm going to have two more things I'm going to let you go, but I don't want to take up everybody's time. The guy who started with Du Bois, who became race first, and he broke away from NAACP, and you also told me that Booker T. Washington gave some monies from the Carnegies or the Mellons for Du Bois to be sponsored for something. You told me about something, how he was instrumental in giving some funding. What was it?
Well, it was said that Andrew Carnegie gave Du Bois a blank check. And he allowed him, without necessarily the accounting that one would might expect, to do what he needed to do. A lot of it was in terms of education, and building schools and creating these institutions that would keep the black life separate. In a sense, in a case, and so they were funding, along with some others, these independent schools. They were funding independent projects and programs. One of the reasons that Atlanta became the black hub of business had a lot to do with what Du Bois was doing over there at Clark Atlanta, which is another project. What Du Bois did. If he took Clark Atlanta and made that what Booker T. Washington was doing at Tuskegee.
And, really?
You got to really look at that. Clark Atlanta was Du Bois. And he didn't start it. It was started by Presbyterians, I think. But he had a free hand in a lot of that. He was challenged in some ways with some of the policy, but that was his that was like his think tank. That was his incubator.
So Booker T helped him to get hooked up with Carnegie, Andrew Carnegie.
Yep, he sure did. He allowed his money, and Carnegie didn't necessarily ask for validation on any of that. That was another part. So he was able to do things very quietly, under the cover. Booker T was giving money for people who were filing lawsuits against the country, and he was allowing he was paying for court cases for those who had been arrested for doing all different kinds of things, you know, undercover. And he would do it various kind of ways.
So they liked Booker T, like that. He had the machine, and they liked him. So he was able to do a whole lot of things.
Lewis Holland, H-A-R-L-A-N, is his biographer. He's a Caucasian, and he did some detailed work on what Booker T was doing. He went into, and one of the critical things about that research is you are able to look at the letters. See, what you got to look at, you got to look at Booker T. Washington's letters that he wrote back and forward to people. Because
I've seen the ones that he wrote back to Marcus Garvey. I've seen those going back and forth.
Yeah, see, that's what you got to use. You got to use that because those are the ones that were private. They were quiet. You didn't get those up front. He could kind of say some of the things that he needed to say without anybody knowing about it, you know, and a lot of that. And then I guess the only deal now is what archive are they in, who's holding them, you know, and why they're holding them. It's all political stuff, you know, sometimes.
Okay. And my one more thing to you is the gentleman who parted with Du Bois, who was in opposition with him, who became Race First. What was his name?
What do you remember his name? I mean,
about the beginning of the show. Said this guy was a Du Bois in the movement, and then he left and became Race First, and they became
Trotter.
Who?
Trotter.
Trotter.
Monroe Trotter.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Henry Monroe and Trotter.
Yeah, Henry Monroe. That was his adversary. You know, they were Trotter was from a wealthy family, and he was very political, and he did not like some of the things. Again, you got to be careful though, in terms of how you look at that. You got to really research that. There is some indication that some of the reason for his dismay with W was not necessarily over ideology, but personal reasons. But again, you gotta look at that very carefully. But I have read some of the struggles they went through.
Thank you for your call.
Robinson, you know, you told me so much, man. You might want to make me write a book, and I want to co-author it with you because I can go grab
okay.
the country with this.
I'll hold you to that. I might hold you to that. But I really appreciate you listening. And check us out every Tuesday from 8 to 10.
Yeah.
Love to have you talk to you. We're going to have these kind of discussions. We'll have folks like Mr. Pugh and others who are going to come on, and we're going to pull the covers back. I like to do that. So if we pull the covers back and see what we see and try to make sense out of it. You know, we don't know. We ain't got all the answers, but we can at least together see if we can find.
Exactly. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Let's go. You got another one, Dr. Rogers.
Let me make two brief comments about Du Bois and the political. One of the ways to understand Du Bois in Africa is to think about his Souls of Black Folk, and think about Makonda, and this concept of what would Black people be like if they were not suppressed by whites. And so that was his vision for Africa. His idea was to essentially realize the potential of Blacks as a people, really the equivalent of the vision that the Germans had to essentially realize their potential if they were not dominated by other kinds of cultures. Now, the other dimension, the political dimension, to understand the political, the best way I think to understand is to think about the polar bear. The polar bear lives perfectly in harmony with himself and his environment, but he's not able to survive because of the culture that is created by human beings. Well, that's the same problem that Black people have, is that regardless of what our strategy was. In fact, I remember reading about what's her name, who wrote The Alchemy. In any case, she's at Columbia. But in any case, she wrote a piece about Pittsburgh, about the Hill District in Pittsburgh, and mm-hmm. about the urban renewal or the black destruction of the Hill District in Pittsburgh. And so here's a case where even if a community is viable, unless they have a political boundary around their space, there's no way they can defend it. And so so the problem we have is the problem that the polar bear has, is that we've got to somehow or another develop a way to prevent hostile others from encroaching on our territory. And until we do that, it really doesn't matter what strategy we come up with. It's not going to be viable. You're going to get what you got in Tulsa or in Eatonville or in other places where
Now, I know you developed a community model that you shared with me and a few others that I think I definitely like. Is there an example of a place or a city now where you think something like that could take place?
Well, you know, in fact, one of the things, by the way, Kwame Ture, within a year, I guess this was 1998 when he was interviewed, and he died. I'm not sure. He died shortly after that. But he was interviewed by Brian Lamb, and Brian Lamb basically, you know, asked him, hey, you know, was all your work for naught? You know, was that useful and all that? And he said, oh, no, it's very useful. I can see signs of, you know, of progress and so on that we've made. But then when he got to the question of black power, what he said is that, well, you know, one of the issues, though, you know, we still don't have black power. And the notion of, you know, individual power, well, obviously, you know, that's not going to be the answer. And then he talked about, you know, having a political, you know, having people in office, may not necessarily be the answer. And so on. Well, one of the things that you see when you go and you look at what's his name, Antwar, what's his name, Lumumba.
Patrice Lumumba.
Chokwe Antar Lumumba.
Chokwe Antar Lumumba, the son of Chokwe Lumumba, in Jackson, Mississippi, with his People's Assemblies. Because ultimately, by the way, let me give the definition of what it would mean if you had black power. The best. Now, I just gave the example. First of all, we're, as black people, we're fundamentally human beings. And as human beings, what you aspire to for yourself is the same thing you aspire to for other people. Now, when you're not a human being, then you've got all kind of stupid notions about what's desirable. But as human beings, you want liberty and justice for all. Now, the instantiation of that is that on the one hand, everyone has these four freedoms, the ability to defend their community, the ability for their community to communicate internally and externally, the ability for their community to provide for themselves and consume what they provide. And then finally, the ability of their community to make adjustments to their community as they see fit. Those are the four freedoms. But the other thing that you got to have, if you want to have, if you want to be free, is you got to have the beloved community. And I don't mean the model of beloved community that Martin Luther King talked about initially, and then he realized that was a problem, because that model of a beloved community was basically the pure integrationist model, which basically says that your project is to wash from yourself anything that's different than your enemies, and somehow or another find a way to blend in. But when you have a real beloved community, then what you have is this. You constitute a family. Your families, when you integrate them, they become a community. Your community, when you integrate them, they become a society. And your society, when you integrate it, it becomes an ecology. And so when you've got a beloved community, what you have is a relationship between different communities, different societies within an ecology. And so one of the examples is that when you look at Jackson, Mississippi, you've got an incipient movement that's beginning with the people. It's not beginning with, you know, some kind of talented tenth or some, a gifted individual, but it's rather beginning with the people themselves identifying what it is that they desire. And that that kind of thing is happening all over the world. In fact, everyone talks about Davos every year. In other words, on Magic Mountain, where, where the few get together and talk about how they want the world to be. But there's an alternative movement at Porto Alegre, the movement of the South, the movement of the people themselves. That's an indigenous movement that talks about this ideal of how is it that we can realize a world that enables the polar bear to coexist.
Who's doing that now that you can see that? Who's doing that in terms of our community? Is there anybody that you can specifically?
As I said, one example you see is you see it in Jackson with the People's Assembly. And one of the things about these are all incipient movements in the sense that, in other words, we are troops that have been crushed to earth. And so we're rising. So you don't expect us to just immediately get up from being crushed and get to sprinting, right? In other words, we got to crawl and do some things. So that's going on. You see another example is in Newark with Ross Baraka, in other words, these things where you're essentially making space for the people to be at the table. Another place is in Georgia with Abrams, Stacey Abrams. When she's got her campaign, her message fundamentally is that people should vote for black women because the policies of black women advance the interests of everybody. I mean, that's the kind of a space that needs to be created for us if we're ever going to be able to. In fact, this notion of you somehow or another getting some territory and therefore you're going to be free. Well, the history of the world is full of examples. In fact, the whole history of colonization is people coming and taking your stuff. So unless you have the ability to defend your stuff, you really ain't got no stuff. And so and that's where the political comes in, is that right now the real heavy lifting is being done in creating a space for the coexistence of difference in the world that enables a space for animals and non-animals to coexist. In any case, I'll let it go with that.
You got a caller, Dr. Roger.
You have another? Okay. Next caller. Good afternoon, caller.
Yes, good afternoon, brothers, Brother Rogers, and the guests, the rest of the guests.
I like
what I'm hearing this evening. But I got a few comments, and I got a question, looking back at the 20s, at the period you was talking about with around in the 20s, the early with the World War I,
right,
what was going on with the Garvey movement and everything, with Tulsa, Oklahoma, all those black communities that were destroyed. We were never able to replicate that again,
Right.
At Tulsa, Oklahoma, from that time, that's 100 years ago, to now, we have never been able to replicate that in America.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Mm-hmm.
So if we use history as the benchmark, I don't think we're going to replicate that here in America again. The powers that be, especially with what's going on now, because the dynamics are taking place in South Africa, where the black people say, look, we're going to take this land back, And the Europeans say, okay, well, we're going to accommodate our people here. Now, how is that going to affect us here? Because, once they start taking that land back, they're going to put their foot down on black people in this part of the world more.
Right.
Right?
I agree.
We have to expect that. We can't say, oh, we'll sit there looking, you know. So, and them crackers is never going to take Africa back. Because, you know, I have been a part of this program a long time. And in Namibia, they got them crackers circled up with all kinds of machine guns and everything. They'll never, ever take that, you know what I'm saying? Never.
Yes.
So,
yes.
I think we should join with our people, with the larger mass body of our people in Africa to strengthen mm-hmm. our position here. You see what I'm saying? Because as they say, as the grip tighten, they're going to put more pressure on us here. So we have to make those links with our people in Africa, you know, economically, culturally, whatever way to move our people out of here. Because, you know, there is no solution for us here in America. 400 years, 2019 coming, it's going to be 400 years we've been here. And if there was any human relationship to be worked on with these people, we could have worked it out with them in 400 years. So they have no intention of working out anything with us unless they're on the top and we're on the bottom, right? That's the word. That's the type of relationship they want us to work out. So,
well, actually, no. Actually, it's the exact opposite of that. In fact, the debate that's going on right now, the debate between Trump and, for example, Oprah Winfrey, that's a debate about what the direction of the world should be. In other words, the things are coming to a head. That one of the things that has been established is that the European does not have a strategy for existing in this world. He doesn't have a theory of how he personally can exist, and he certainly doesn't have a theory of coexistence. And so what needs to happen is that there needs to be the intervention of an alternative way of being in the world, and that's what's happening today. There are people today that are contending at the level of the elder, at the spiritual level, as to what are the values that ought to obtain in the world. The kind of realpolitik that you're talking about, this kind of power politics that, you know, we take, you know, stuff and whatnot, everyone is increasingly aware that that's an adolescent mentality that cannot be sustained. And so the challenge is that the people themselves from the ground are coming up in opposition to that. And so one of the things to do is you've got to use wisdom like an elder, in the sense of you've got to see around the corners. You've got to see, in other words, you've got to read between the lines. You've got to see that there's changes that are occurring. One of the things that's happening right now is that you've got Donald Trump and you've got the fascists in the world, a handful of white people around the world who are trying to reassert themselves among the world. But the reality is that they don't even have majority support of white people. And so one of the things that you want to do, if you want to, you know, you talked about 400 years of analysis. If you wanted to really do the analysis, you'd ask the question, what was the state of mind of white people 400 years ago relative to the conquest of the world? And then ask the question, what is the state of mind of white people today relative to the conquest of the world? And what you'll find is that they were largely in agreement 400 years ago, but today...
They're still in agreement, brother.
What you see today is that you see tension among white people about what their strategy is for being in the world. Now, one of the things that, for example, the fascist forces would want to do is they'd want to assure them that as white people that they don't have a choice. In fact, if you look at Martin Luther King's analysis of racism, you know, he said that one of the reasons for racism is that white people have a fear that they will have to pay for the things that they've done in the past. And so as a result, you know, they're reluctant, you know, to give up any kind of power. Another reason is that for racism is that the advantages of suppressing, you know, other people. And then a third reason for racism he talked about
is that a value system that talks about the conquest of nature in its entirety. Well, those are problematics of change. In other words, once you recognize that you've got a person that has these issues of fear, these issues of political domination, and these issues of ecological domination, then you can begin systematically to address these issues. And those are the things that are being done right now today. And by the way, the leading force in this is Black women.
Yeah, well, I really don't think that telling white folks about, you know, what they are doing wrong or anything like that is going to change their mentality. You know, I don't think that you come into them and say, you know what, you know, you're destroying the planet, you're doing it. They know what the hell they're doing. They're the one doing it, you see? And I can't speak for white people because white people have a different psychological makeup and a different history than me. See, I got to speak for myself. And based on my history and what I have seen, you know, they ain't going to change. White folks ain't going to change. And we know the world know that white folks, something is wrong with them. Hold on. Let me finish, brother.
Your position can't be sustained. You said based
hold on
what
brother.
You said,
Let me finish, right? As I said, I don't think they're going to change. I really don't think they're going to come into the human family. And you see the world now, they're preparing to deal with him. But the problem is, you know who is preventing the world from dealing with him? Us. Because we here stuck with him and trying to get along with him. You see, the world would have probably put what they were going to put on him. But we here with him trying to save him. And Basha, let's get along. You can't get along with those people. Those people, they don't have it in their psychological makeup. Well, you have other people who have been affected by the European man. Remember, it's not only us now. No, you know, you have the China man.
Who are the people who are opposed to? Okay, so China and India, right?
Yeah, China, India, other colored people of the world. They're sick and tired of this man. We know that, you see. But again, you know, there is no real dissent coming from the Black people here to the world. You know, so every time the world look, they see the Black man coming. If there is a war to break out now, who's going to be at the front line? Black men. Black men going to be at the front line. So the world said, hold on now. this man here, he's siding with the white man every time. Every time we look up, we see the Black man coming. He's siding with the white man, and he getting victimized. So I said, you know, we got to withdraw ourselves from them. See? You know, and take a military stance. But as I said, I don't see no humanity that they're gonna come into the human family. I doubt they really have that in their ability. You know, I doubt they have that in their, you know. But we need power. You know what I'm saying? And I said political power comes out of the barrel of a gun. We ain't gonna vote ourselves here in America because they still are the majority here in America. In spite of, you know, they are still the majority. So, you know, my thing is Africa. It's Africa for the African. Everybody came, they followed Garvey program. The Chinese came, they said, wow, that sounds good. They went ahead and they on their way to freedom. The Indian came, they said, you know what, Garvey's program sounds good. The only people who did not accept Garvey's program is the people who Garvey came for. Us.
Yes. That's true.
So, you know, until we pick up where Garvey left off, we're going to be here another 100 years rubbing our gums and we condition and change. Anyway, brothers, thank you so much.
Brother,
I'll continue listening.
Thank you.
Brother,
thank
they,
you, brother.
They killed people by the millions. And so the notion that somehow or another you can go to a country and you can defend it. I mean, the first statement that you made that somehow or another you can't see change. The reality is that white people have changed. In fact, that's all you've seen is the people essentially trying to adapt themselves to what they think they need to be in order to be successful in the world. That's what you've seen over the last 2,500 years. You've seen the people who considered themselves inferior to other people and essentially thought that this was the strategy, this strategy of Alexander the Great and of conquest and so on. This was the way for them to be something in the world. So that's all you've seen is white people changing. And so the notion that white people can't change, that's contradicted by the history. But the second thing that you're saying is this notion that somehow or another that we can go to Africa, and because we are in Africa, and because, for example, there are, say, 1 billion black people, and by the way, I think the rate of population growth is such that by 2050, black people, are going to be, I think, the number two population group in the world. But that's all irrelevant. These people got technology to kill people by the billions. And so what we've got to do, the first thing we've got to do is we've got to establish the ability for human beings to coexist on this planet. Now that does not mean, for example, integration. It means creating. In fact, the best analogy for what I'm talking about, first of all, the worst analogy, the integration model, what that leads to is a plantation or a monoculture. The model that I'm talking about, the best example of that, you see it in the Amazon. It's a rainforest. And in the rainforest, what you have in the rainforest is the maximum possibility of life. What you have on a plantation is the minimum possibility of life. And by the way, these black nationalisms that we're talking about, these are just European nationalisms in blackface, in the sense that the whole project that they have, if you ask the question, what is their goal? Their goal is the conquest of nature in the same sense that that the Europeans are talking about.
But James, explain that. You said it's black. It's black nationalism is nationalism in black with white faces. Is that what you say again? Say what you said.
Precisely right. In other words, what I'm saying is that when you look at the black nationalist project. The best way of thinking about it, in other words, when somebody says they want black power, well, black is a synthetic construct. Now, if someone says that, for example, I want Akan power, well, the Akan are a people. But even in the case of Akan, it turns out that if you go and you look at the people who speak the Akan language, there are several different sub-tribes that are involved in that. And so whenever you start talking about liberty and justice for all, then what you're talking about is something a whole lot smaller than the level of some aggregation of billions of people, right? In other words, in fact, the simplest way of understanding that is that you've got children, and once your children get grown, they want to have the same capacities that you have. And you recognize that the only way that they're going to be able to do the things that you do is if they have their own space. Well, that's the same way peoples are. And so the notion that somehow or another, because all the people speak the same language, therefore you can put them together in aggregations, of millions and billions, that's absurd. That has never been sustained anywhere in nature. In fact, the natural size of a human group is really less than 2,000 people, really. And so whenever you start talking larger, whenever you're talking about groups larger than 2,000 people, you're talking about synthetic aggregations that can only be brought about through technology such as weaponry or agriculture or religion. In other words, you've got to have some kind of binding technology that would enable people to aggregate beyond what are the natural limits that are within that. So,
another caller, Dr. Rocky.
Okay. Thank you, my brother, for calling. I appreciate it. We'll be here every Tuesday from 8 to 10. Okay, next caller. Good afternoon, caller.
Good evening, Dr. Rogers.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm doing fine. You guys sound real good.
Good. I'm glad you called because I want you to talk about some of the other programs that we got coming up. I know you said that piece to me, but I need you to express that. But go right ahead if you got a question or remark, though, brother.
Sure. I'll announce those programs at this time. This is Brother Oshie. My program is African Perspectives, and I broadcast every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. The times I'm going to give are Eastern time. I broadcast every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. On Monday, we have a program, Acres of Diamonds, Community Affairs program. Right after that, and Acres of Diamonds is from 6 to 8. And at, from 8 to 9 is Let's Buy Black 365, which is also a podcast. And that's on Monday. And, of course, Tuesday, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers, every right. Tuesday from 8 to 10. On Wednesday, Sister Revive, a POC, tomorrow, POC, Proof of Consciousness, Revive. And then Thursday, Us Lifting Up, Hulu, the Economic Development Cooperative for Our People, which is from 9 until. On Friday, it's Friday, and it's 8 p.m. Eastern Time, it's Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. And then on Saturdays, it's Sports Talk. Saturday Sports Talk with Troy Wilmore from 10 to 12. And then on Sundays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., no, it's not me, it's Revive, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern, Revive with Sister POC. Then Sunday evening, it's Time for an Awakening, 7 o'clock, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Those are the programs we have on Time for Awakening Media.
Good. Thank you, my brother. Thank you.
Oh, you know it.
Next program, I'll have that all lined up. All
right. Oh, for sure. Every Tuesday, family. Right here on TimeForAnAwakening.com and BlackTalkRadioNetwork.com. Black Reality.
Brother Ocean, let me ask you, has Black Power got its place today?
Well, let's break that down. I know I was listening to Brother Pugh, and he was killing me with a lot of those theoretics. But let's break that down. We're talking about power. I the most definitive definitions I felt was Dr. Wade Nobles. He said that power is the ability to define reality, then have someone else accept your definition as if it's their own.
Right.
And, you know, Europeans exercise that some kind of so-called power because they define reality. And they impose that reality on others and make others believe that their reality was also theirs.
Okay.
And so people accepted that definition. And contained in that definition was a devaluing of self, you know, of who you were historically and culturally and as a human being, you know. And so the question that we need to ask ourselves as African people, not just here in America but globally, is who are we now? In Europeans' reality, we know what they were when they came out of that dark age, that medieval age, that primitive age of the dark ages, land poor, resource poor, and people poor, and they had their renaissance. In fact, one of the things that was coming up as a young man was learning history, and I'll never forget one of the first things I learned about in middle school, maybe grammar school, was the Renaissance of man. And, of course, the Europeans imposed it as it was really the renaissance of humanity. Well, of course, it was not. It was the awakening of Europeans. But how they told the story was that there is nobody other than them. And then they had this awakening where Marco Polo goes to China, and he brings back pasta. And that's why people think that pasta is Italian. But really, pasta is Chinese. That's like people think rice is Chinese, but rice is really African.
Right.
What he brought back even deeper was fireworks, gunpowder that the Chinese use for celebration. But this is what Europeans use to fashion superior weaponry. If there's one thing about Europeans that I understood, is, am I looking at their history, they always found a better way to kill your ass. They always found a better way to torture you and to kill you. All of the weaponry that they have invented up until this point of the weapons of mass destruction. And so we need to ask ourselves, who are we in their reality? Well, of course, when they stole us, that's why I say we should never call ourselves slaves because we were not slaves, we were captives.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if you think that words have meaning, and they do, So when I say a word, what image comes into your mind? What do you conjure up? If I say the word slave, now automatically you put our face on it.
Mm-hmm.
See? Thug, you put our face on it. Drug addict, no fit father, no fit mother. Words have meaning.
Okay.
So first we were the soulless people, no culture to speak of. We were primed for servitude. We were primed for captivity. In fact, they used the biblical story of Ham to justify that biblically. And then at one time they said we were happy to be that. Then, of course, when the so-called emancipation happened, now we are some lazy coons, you know, some porch monkeys. So who are we in their reality then, and who are we in their reality today?
Mm-hmm.
I just mentioned who we are, the thugs, the drug addicts, no fit fathers, the most fit mothers, the lazy, the scourge. I mean, they already said, one Caucasian lady just the other day said that children of affluent African Americans still can't compete with regular Caucasians. We don't measure up. We're intellectually incapable.
Let me ask you, so in answering that question that you just asked, how does that support any kind of agenda that we need to determine or establish or any kind of process we need to put in place that would aid into the change that we know that must be done? How to answer that question?
I think that we everything that we should be doing is for the for independence, self-determination, liberation, and sovereignty for African people.
Okay.
Everything that we do should be in that vein. The education. Okay. So now we're not in charge of the education. Okay. You can get a charter school here or there. There are some schools that are African-centered. Some do well. Some do not. But basically, the educational process in this country, be it public, parochial, whatever, is not good for us. So
okay.
Even though that is the case, the European Jews send their kids to these schools, but they don't send their kids to school to learn what it means to be a European Jew. That is their responsibility. We should take that same situation, that teaching our young people who they are, their culture, their history, is our responsibility. I often said that the Association for the Study of Classical African Civilization, ASCAT, should be the educational arm for liberation for our people. They should develop a curriculum, just like on Sunday, Doc, you know this. The Baptist Church on Sunday has the same Sunday school lesson in Milwaukee, Atlanta, Dallas, Los Angeles, wherever, if it's the Baptist church.
Right.
They have that same lesson. And so I say the ASCAT should develop a curriculum where we have the same lesson each Saturday or Friday, and not just for young people or children, but even for our adults.
Well,
because
that's
right.
We need the education. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And so we should be developing a curriculum like that with our people and for those who want to. Those who really want to open their hearts and open their minds, those who want to be liberated from this madness will come. And then once that happens, and that happens across the seas, throughout the diaspora and on the continent, we can come together. Because as Marcus, the brother who called earlier, brother from Jamaica, Marcus, brother Marcus, he said, we cannot coexist here. There is no coexistence with Europeans, except in a position of superior and inferior. And just as Abraham Lincoln said, I as much as any man is having the superior position assigned to Caucasians, to the Europeans. So,
and I think this administration is driving that point home that's on the table now, and that's the way we're going to move. Because, we're hearing some horrendous stories of the interaction between Europeans and blacks, and it's off the chain, as young people say, and some of the things that they're doing, the blatant stuff.
Dr. Henry Clark said it best: we have no friends.
Yes, exactly.
And when I look at the world today, everywhere dark-skinned people are, they are demeaned, they are degraded, they're relegated to the low rung of any scale, of any ladder,
Right.
They're abused, they are murdered, their land is taken. We have no friends.
Okay.
You know?
Mr. Pugh, you want to make a comment?
Well, yeah. Oh, see, one of the things that you started talking about was the power of words. And one of the things to recognize is that the real basis for European power in the world began with words. And so we all have, in other words, all of us have four kinds of power. Our image is a power. Our story is a power. Our actions are a power. And finally, our values are a power. And our values, those are our words, right? And it turns out that right now, the fundamental problem in the world is that the two values that are competing are the values of life and the values of death. But the problem is that we don't understand that we don't understand what the value of death is. But I'll just say that quickly, and then I'll give you what my strategy is that I think will dovetail with what you're talking about. The fundamental problem is the problem of life versus death, or the problem of technology versus biology. Human beings have to die, and so the technological strategy is that I'm going to find somebody else to die in my place. The biological strategy says that, okay, if death is part of the bargain, what I'm going to do is I'm going to have children so that my children can survive, right? So those are the two strategies that are operating in the world today, the strategy of life versus death, of having children versus having technology. What that leads to is that if you want to try the biological strategy, then that means you want to align yourself with nature. So you need to understand how nature works. You need to understand ecology. If you want to try the technological strategy, then you want to superimpose your will upon nature. That means that you want to understand economics. Now, if you're interested in understanding economics, then you need someone to help you, and there's only a few people in the world who are interested in advancing death, and so you need to align yourself with the few. They're going to have names. They're going to call themselves elite and all that. The only thing you know for sure is it ain't but a few of them. If, on the other hand, you want to align yourself with nature and use the ecological strategy that leads toward life, then it turns out every rock, every weed, every roach, and every drop of water in nature is aligned with nature. And all you got to do is watch them, and they'll show you what your rhythms need to be. And then the final dimension, the spiritual dimension, is that if you're interested in the death project, then that means that you're going to worship the mind. You're going to use the gangster rule, the rule that says that might makes right, that because I'm stronger than you, ipso facto, I should be your boss. If, on the other hand, you want to align yourself with life, with biology, then you want to follow the golden rule. The golden rule says right makes might, that doing the right thing leads to might. So here's what I say to people, is that each of us let's say that a human being is supposed to have a dollar to spend, but let's say that because of oppression that our community, members of our community, only have 3 cents that we can spend with any kind of absolute authority. Well, what I say is that it turns out that if we spend these 3 pennies that we have judiciously, they aggregate over time. And so the challenge is to figure out how to spend and where to spend. And so what I say to folks is that if you have a model that shows you what your options are, and I just gave you what the physical options were, life versus death, what the logical options were, ecology versus economics, what the social options were, align yourself with the few or align yourself with the many, and what the spiritual options are, follow the golden rule, that is, your heart, or follow the gangster rule, that is, your mind, then what happens is that whenever you get a chance to spend that 3 cents that's discretionary, that you don't have to spend on food, clothing, and shelter, you will invest it in things that lead toward your project, the life project. And it turns out that's what our strategy is. And over time, that's going to manifest itself. It's sort of like people talking about compound interest that, you know, if you save, you know, a dollar a day, you know, after a while, you know, you got enough money to do something with. And okay. That's the same way things are.
Okay, let me ask you a quick question, because I know we got about 20 minutes. Going back to Africa, is that a viable plan, do you think? And I know the answer, but I just want you to talk about it a little bit, because you're talking about plans of action, you know, to address it. Is that really viable?
It is the only viable solution for African people.
Okay.
In fact, if we don't see this as we speak, when you look at everybody wants to be in Africa, because that's where the resources are. When I use the in my clothes, I use the quote of Stephen Biko, the most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor, the European, the Caucasian, the cracker, the white man. The most potent weapon in his hand is the mind of the oppressed. And
right.
My program is dedicated to helping to free the African mind, but not just right. The MINE, but the MINE, because under the feet of African people lies all the resources, as Dr. John Henry Clark quotes, all the resources that everybody wants, think they can't do without, and don't want to pay for.
Right.
It is a constant rip off of Africa. Africa's not poor, it's being looted. And because of colonization and ignorance and desperate and all this neocolonialism, it's a damn mess. And the most technologically advanced Africans on this planet reside here. What if these Africans who get all this information, all this education, will come to work with brothers and sisters on the continent, get rid of the damn Chinese, because you got Chinese married Ugandan women to try to stake their claim in Africa for their kids, so their kids can bring them over. So they can continue to build in China off Africa's resources. And the same thing with Europeans. Many Europeans never left.
Right.
The Germans never left Namibia.
Right.
The Europeans, okay. The Dutch and the British never left Southern Africa. They still run it.
Okay.
And that's going to be very interesting to see what happens in Zimbabwe and in South Africa with this land reform move. Already the Europeans who stole what is now called Australia said, we're going to give you some special immigration. We'll,
okay.
If they take your land without compensating you, we'll allow you to immigrate to Australia. And I'm not surprised that they're going to do that here.
Okay.
But
Mr. Peter, is Africa a viable plan of action for black people today in America, 2018?
Well, I think that, you know, that there are many viable options, and certainly
like
Africa.
Like what? Any viable options? Like what? Like what?
Well. For example, one of the issues that you have is that you've got to. Right now, we've got to solve the problem of coexistence on the planet.
That problem has
not been solved.
With
right?
us or with somebody else? Coexistence between us? But we've been divided. Because the Europeans...
No. I'm saying...
And the European has sowed the seeds of discord and division. They are the perpetrators.
I'm not talking about coexistence between black people. I mean coexistence between black people and white people. That problem has not been solved.
It has
to be solved first, right?
It will never be solved.
Hold on, Pew.
We begged, we marched, we sat in, we pleaded, we begged each other to go vote. We did every damn thing. There is none, brother. Stop it.
Oh, shit. What I'm talking about is that the same problem that we have with the white man, that's the problem that the polar bear has with the white man. He's got the same problem.
You're right.
So what I'm saying to you is that problem has to be solved. There's nothing wrong with the way the polar bear is living his life. But increasingly, the polar bear is becoming less and less viable because the white man is living a lifestyle, which, for example, he really doesn't need to live. In fact, to live on this planet, a human being only needs to consume 4,000 calories a day. The average person in the world today is consuming 35,000 calories a day. The average person in America is consuming 100,000 calories a day. And people that want to live large, like Oprah Winfrey with multiple houses and flying all over the world, they might be consuming at the million calorie a day level. So what's happening is that these people have these absurd lifestyles that are generated intellectually beginning with a word. And by the way, we all have power over words. In their case, the word is technology. The word is Elon Musk going to Mars, that kind of nonsense. This is what precludes the possibility of the polar bear existing, and it precludes the possibility of African people existing. It's the reason for the scramble for African resources. So that problem has to be solved, and it can be solved because, as we just said, the power of words, that right now, in fact, the you know, one of the things that that has to happen, you know, in fact, if you go and you look at the Europeans and you look at the kinds of things that that the Romans did, for example, the Romans would only eat at certain times a day, whether they were hungry or not. And they would only eat certain portions of food because they were trying to prove to themselves that they weren't animals. And the reason they were trying to prove to themselves that they weren't animals is that evidently when they encountered people who called it, who considered themselves more civilized, they looked down upon them. And so one of the first things that Romans did is try to differentiate themselves from nature. And so that whole process of, well, I'm not a part of nature, and the proof of that is I need to conquer nature and so on. Well, that kind of logic has been permeating their society for the last 2,500 years. Well, that has to be deconstructed because you can't coexist with people with nuclear weapons. Regardless, you can't coexist with people who have these biochemical weapons. So what has to happen is that that has to be deconstructed, and it can't be deconstructed by us simply imitating them with competition. Because that's, by the way, all these nationalisms are is just competition, because it's basically us trying to develop us some kind of technological advantage, sort of like what the Russians were doing. In fact, you saw what that led to. It led to mutually assured destruction, where, you know, I figure out, you know, some kind of way where you can't attack me, and you figure out some kind of way where I can't attack you. And now we're in a position where if anybody gets really mad at somebody, they can end the world. That's where we're at today. It requires wisdom. It doesn't require knowledge or power. It requires wisdom.
I'm saying that being the reality, and understand who we're dealing with, okay?
We're dealing with immature human beings. That's who we're dealing
with. Exactly. And so there is no reasoning. What you have said cannot happen because there is no reasoning. There is no coming together to an understanding of the lines between Caucasians and everybody outside of him. They made a pact some time ago when they came out of that, once again, referring to that dark age, that medieval evil age, when Charlemagne came to the fore and all those others, and they kicked the Moors out of Spain, they kicked the Sephardic Jews out of Spain, you know, and they went around the world claiming everybody's stuff in the name of France, England, Portugal, Spain, whatever. They made a determination that whoever's going to run the world is going to be us. We may have warred amongst ourselves, but we're going to come together on those who are outside of us.
Yes, Osha, but you just said that was an agreement that they came to in the time of Charlemagne, right?
Okay.
Right? So that means that they changed to arrive at that agreement. So if you ask the question, what was the state of mind that come? First of all, that was an absurd agreement that they had, this notion that somehow or another they can control the world, the notion that that would be desirable to do, and the notion that that would even be possible to do. That was absurd. But why did they come up with that in the first place, right?
Well, let me say this. Hold on, Pew, because the absurdity is real.
You have
1% of the people who are running the world who are predominantly European, who are predominantly Caucasian. They control 90% of the world's resources. While people are living in filth and squalor, they are living to such degrees that it's unimaginable. They have billions of dollars.
Yes, but let me just remind you of one other factor. Do you remember that when we were living on plantations, that one of the things that was a commonplace was that the whites would say, well, if we've got our foot on these people's necks, what are these people happy about? What do they have to sing about? In other words, see, one of the things that happens when you're dealing with an immature people who are living a lifestyle which is not even sustainable for themselves. And by the way, here's the proof that European culture is not even desirable for Europeans. When you have a culture that's desirable for a people, it has two properties. It's compatible with nature. That is to say, nature allows the culture to continue. And it's compatible with the needs of the people themselves so that the people want it to continue. So to give you an example of that, if you look at what the Vikings did with the Inuit when they conquered the Inuit in 400 AD, they developed a culture that they were satisfied with. But the problem was that their culture was incompatible with nature, and so 1,000 years later, they starved to death. On the other hand, when you look at the Europeans and you see their what they call history, this constant change in their culture, that means that the culture does not meet the needs of the people themselves, and that's what's driving the change. So what I'm saying is that what that tells you is this. It's sort of like, you know, you're looking at in fact, the analogy I like to use is that imagine you've got a teenager sitting in a convenience store with a pistol. He tried to stick it up, but he knows that, you know, the police are outside. They say, you're surrounded, you know, you should put the gun down and come out. But he knows that the police have been known, you know, to gun people down. So he's afraid to put the gun down because he doesn't trust the police. But on the other hand, he knows he doesn't have any wind, you know, in this store, you know, forever. And so that's the dilemma that white people are in, that they understand that what they have now is not viable and not sustainable. But on the other hand, they are afraid to back up and think of any alternative. But let me give you the example for what to do.
I need to make it kind of short. We're coming to an end.
Oh, yeah. This is going to be real tight and real quick. If you look at horses, for example, they're afraid of you. But, you know, if you listen to the horse whisper, he says that when you're dealing with a creature who's afraid of you, that all you have to do is slowly approach that creature. And you have to approach them slow enough so that they realize you're not a threat. And once you get established to that creature that you're not a threat, and by the way, that's one of the things that Barack Obama did to get elected in the first place that Jesse Jackson couldn't do, is that once you establish you're not a threat to them, now you can lead them. And since they can't lead themselves, that means that once you lead them, then you can begin to deconstruct all these absurd notions that Charlemagne and Machiavelli and Alexander the Great and all of these people came up with. That's what our challenge is. And we have to create the possibility for the polar bear to exist on the planet because it doesn't exist right now.
Okay. You know, I think one of the things, and I really really appreciate this discussion, this has been dynamic for you to call, Oshie, and we get this kind of energy. But I think one of the things as I listen to both of you is that there is some work we still got to do as it relates to developing a framework for change. We are even loose there. There are a lot of loose screws in that framework to do that. And I think that's one of the things I wanted to talk about today, particularly looking at the Black Power movement and seeing what could be borrowed from there. Are there still viable principles there? And then obviously very clearly your plan of repatriation, you know, is something that's on the table. I'm definitely with you on that, but I've got some questions because I know Africa's got some troubles. And I know, again, you're dealing with that enemy that we keep talking about that's global. He's a global enemy, and you've all both said that. And I don't think that anybody's going to that enemy is not going to stand for any type of nationalistic, strong development. You know, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in South Africa because, you know, he's doing some things there, and that, you know who that is. That's Germans. It's the Germans and the British. So it's going to be interesting how that response moves forward. But again, I think we got some work to do. So in closing, we got 8 minutes. What are some first steps, beginning steps that we need to make to try to resolve some of this that you all have been talking about that obviously is not clear yet as it relates to putting together agenda? So, James, let me start with you. Like I said, I got 8 minutes. So and then I want to hear Oshie give his piece.
Well, my fundamental model is that when anyone has a goal, the first thing they need is they need a plan. The second thing they need is they need a strategy for how they're – excuse me, they need a goal. Secondly, they need a strategy for how they're going to achieve the goal. Third, they need a set of skills that are going to enable them to implement the strategy. And the fourth thing they need is they need the ability to make adjustments either to their goal, to their strategy, or to their skill set. And that's the challenge that we have. In fact, I call our goal what our beauty is. And the beauty of Black people is life. The beauty of the alternative to Black people is death. The strategy for Black people, well, in any case, I'll just leave it at that.
All right. Oshie?
My program, every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we talk about independence, self-determination, liberation, and sovereignty for African people.
Okay.
To me, there is no other discussion. We've done everything. We've tried everything. We sometimes have acted more Caucasian than the Caucasian. We've been pleading, begging, marching, boycotts. We've done it all. The only thing that we truly have not done, embrace Pan-Africanism, a dynamic Pan-Africanism that is going to be technical, cultural, and spiritual. We have the technology. We have the individuals who deal with technology. We have everything we need. We have what we need. The only thing that we don't have is the right mind.
Could you explain what the difference between independence, liberation, and sovereignty is? I understand self-determination, but what's independence, liberation, and sovereignty?
Very quickly, we do things independent of anybody else. We don't look outside of ourselves to make decisions of what's going to happen with us. We are in control of our lives, and more importantly, in control of our resources. We're in control of our land. We cannot do that here. That cannot happen here. And I know they're going to have a conference at the end of this month in Detroit with the Republic of New Africa. And it's the same thing that the Nation of Islam was talking about. Those things cannot happen here. You cannot have a entity in America. Not even Caucasians can have an entity in America that has speaks to sovereignty or any kind of independence or self-determination. See?
Okay. Okay. All right.
Liberation? Okay. Oh, okay. Well, all right.
No, go ahead. Go right ahead. Finish up.
To be liberated is the same thing. We are not under anybody's control. We are liberated. We are free to make decisions about what happens to us and our people, our family, our land, our resources.
Mm-hmm.
See, this is where we must go. This is the road that we must travel. But yet and still, most of our people are still believing somehow we can use moral persuasion on a people who are amoral. We can somehow appeal to them and make them understand and respect our humanity after all we've been through. We're coming up on 400 damn years. And we
it's not necessarily moral persuasion. There are all kinds of arguments you can make. There are moral arguments, there are verbal arguments, there are physical arguments. In other words, there are different ways you communicate. When I just talked about communicating with a horse. You don't communicate with a horse with words, right? You know,
we're not talking about animals. We're talking about human beings. And one part of the human being family who are the late developers in humanity. Whether you believe in Francis Crest Wells' theory that they believe that they are in fear of genetic annihilation, and so therefore they must control the world population. They must control what happens in the world because they're only less than 10% of the people on the planet, but yet they control 80% of the world's resources. There's something deeply, fundamentally wrong with that dynamic.
And on that, late, my brothers, I got to close out. We got 2 minutes left. I appreciate
that. Peace, Dr. Rogers. God bless you. Thank you.
God bless you, too, brother.
Take care, dear brother.
Enjoy it, though.
I thank Brother Elliot. I thank Brother Kwaku. It took a lot of folks to get us on the air tonight. Hopefully by next week we will have ironed out some of those things that we need to do. We will be here every Tuesday from 8 to 10 o'clock. We will have bigger, invigorating and electrifying discussions such as this. Next week we are hopefully going to interview and talk with the brother who's getting ready to pull together a gang summit out of Cleveland, Ohio. And so we're looking forward to having a wonderful discussion with him about our youth and some of the work that he's doing with those gentlemen throughout the nation. It's not just people from Cleveland, but throughout the nation. So, again, thank all of you, our listeners. Thank you to our callers for calling in who have questions. We appreciate your support, and we look forward to seeing you again on next Tuesday at 8 p.m. God bless you. Thank you.
Shango, mochu baile, Shango, oni wano, eri jaja, ori shako, eru male, Shango.
Shango, yeah, yeah.
Amabu Shango, yeah, yeah.
Amabu Shango.